Hello, and welcome to 18 Group's podcast on best execution from our Intelligent Trading Summit in New York City on June the 12th. The podcast focuses on how to ensure best execution and connectivity across a multi-venue environment and features expert speakers moderated by Chaim Bodek, Managing Principal at Decimus Capital Markets. I hope you find the content useful.
We're going to be talking about best execution, smart order routing. Over the last number of years, this topic, while it's been important, has changed. It used to be much more oriented around how can I avoid getting stepped ahead of by HFTs and that kind of thing. But this year, the debates are really centering on the maker-taker model and the SEC's pilot. So I think we're just going to start with a question for the panel. Whoever feels the most strongly, just jump in and take the, I'm not assigning these, okay? Jump in and take the question. So here's the question. Is the maker-taker pilot needed at all, as opposed to other measures, such as enhanced order routing disclosure, or a holistic re-examination of Reg NMS, or even a permanent reduction in the access fee cap as advocated by Goldman Sachs? Is it necessary, or are there just easier ways to address the problem?
I personally think that while there could be other methods, like you described, that could help the overall environment, the question that the SEC is really trying to answer is, does the maker-taker structure, you know, affect best execution? Does it cause longer queue lines and extra reversion on trades? So I do think that it's extremely, you know, timely, and I think it's needed in this current environment.
So, what's your personal opinion about it?
Personally,
about, you know, does it, you know, to what degree does it impact?
I mean,
I think
that what I've noticed just from trading is that queue lines on the passive side are extremely long. You tend to not get filled until it's like right before a sweep, and then once that sweep occurs, you get a mark out of, you know, negative a couple basis points because the market keeps moving in against you.
So I actually support the pilot program. I think pilot programs are a nice way or safe way to basically test out hypotheses in a very controlled manner, also just to see what other side effects or ramifications it might have. So I think, like, for example, like the tick pilot program, for example, they did that. They ran it for 2 years, and they came back saying, you know what, probably we don't need it. So it just kind of, you know, it's one of those things like how Sherlock Holmes says that you need, in order to make brick, you need clay. So in order to make any conclusion, draw any conclusion, you need to have data. So this is just a data collecting exercise. Now, of course, there is cost to it. So I think that's where the contention is.
Maybe you could comment on, what, as a practitioner, what kinds of unintended, you know, consequences or artifacts, you know, what would we learn from the pilot that might not be obvious?
One is, of course, the unknown, like you don't know what you don't know. So one is that, obviously. So, you know, like, for example, again, I'm looking backwards here, the tick size pilot program. So the original intention behind that was like that for the illiquid stocks, by increasing the spread, increment size, hopefully that'll help improve the liquidity. But it actually didn't have that consequence kind of thing. What ended up happening was, or at least that's what people believe, a lot of those stocks ended up being traded on the ATS platforms versus being traded on the exchange. So it's one of those unknown unknowns, and that's what I think this pilot program hopefully would kind of bring out.
Yeah, there is enough competition, I think, in the marketplace right now, right? So, there are traditional exchanges, there are all kinds of alternative marketplaces, electronic marketplaces, other types of marketplaces. And so, as a practitioner, being on the buy side and building various trading components, so we need to take into consideration everything that's available to us. Well, take into consideration the rebates and the models there, take into consideration the liquidity and availability there, any rules that those particular marketplaces put in, looking at the exchanges. I mean, there are certain latest exchange driven issues that we're hearing about. So it's you have to look at it holistically. What's available in the market? What's available for a regulated exchange? What's available for non-regulated marketplace? And then build your algorithms or build your trading strategies according to what the environment is like at any one moment.
All right, so I have a few questions here that are kind of oriented around this maker-taker debate. I guess I'm going to add one. You know, we've seen some rather contentious comment letters from certain exchanges, making some claims about the cost and the penalty. I think it's hard not to have an opinion about those claims, either for or against. If the panel could just reflect on the impact and cost. To what degree would changes be damaging to the extent that some critics think may be so?
I mean, to me, one of the biggest complaints that I've heard is that exchanges think that spreads will widen. There's a couple things around that specifically. Is the first one is, large cap stocks, very competitive already. There's market makers on both sides of the spread at all times. And if not, naturals. So the liquidity there is not going to change much. As you move down the list to mid-cap and small-cap, most of those stocks are traded for the price that they're traded at, and spreads are widened enough that a rebate doesn't really, it's not an ample percentage of the spread to be made by a market maker for them to stop quoting or need to spread it out even more. And just to bring up a point that we were talking about earlier is in Canada, the TMX, in 2015, they've reduced the fee from 30 to 17. And there was the same type of dispute, spreads will widen. But I know ITG did a study and they said there was no material change in spread size. So, I would think that point's kind of moot at this point.
And if you look at some of the other exchanges, both across Atlantic and here, like IEX doesn't offer any rebate. Yes, it does offer a discount, but it's not a rebate. And if you go across Atlantic to Asian and European markets, they don't offer rebates and they work perfectly fine. So it's just a different rules that we are used to. So out here, I think some of these exchanges are used to offering rebates to bring on or get more liquidity compared to their rivals. So that's just how they play. And that is it.
I mean, I agree with this. I think it's related to the previous point that we mentioned. I think let the market kind of regulate itself. When you're building your smart order routing models and algos, then you take into consideration the fee structure of each marketplace where you trade. And so it's just, wherever it is more advantageous for any given strategy, for any given time to trade, you're going to go to that venue.
And I mean, another point that I've heard from some of these comment letters is they're saying that the SEC doesn't have the authority to implement such a pilot. We have the tick size pilot that we've been talking about already. They've also capped the fees at 30 mils. So for the exchanges now to come out and say, even though the SEC has been changing things this whole time, why should it be any different now? Why should all of a sudden now they don't have the authority to make any changes?
All right, so switching topics, I'm going to go back to the previous debate that used to consume this with a question. How are smart order routers addressing the criticisms of how execution quality is implemented per regulation NMS at different venues? In other words, is high-frequency trading and latency arbitrage still a problem? Was it ever a problem?
Go ahead.
I'll just take it since high frequency trading is kind of my subject. I think personally, I think there should not be any problem there, right? So it's, in my opinion, you're investing more into technology, you're trying to create smarter strategies that will generate profits, hopefully, for you. And I think that's normal for the market. That's normal for sort of our capitalistic system. You know, so I think, you know, the government should not, or the exchanges, regulators, whomever, should not really step in and trying to regulate it too much. But I think there are certain regulations that make sense, but what they do is they are stopping, you know, maybe high-frequency trading guys to just purely operate with, you know, with latency arbitrage, and they try to do other things, right? They try to analyze more, they try to, you know, go across different markets, go across different asset classes, and so the strategies become a little more complex than just pure latency arbitrage, and that's the answer when we see those challenges that are being put together by different entities.
The other, you know, it's one of those things, like, anytime you have regulation, it's good, of course, good to have regulation, but it also has an unintended side effect, consequence. So, like, in this case, Reginomics kind of thing, what it does is oftentimes the high-frequency guys, they can see a pattern. So, like, I mean, going to exchange one, and they know the guy's going to go to exchange two, then three. So they know what's going to happen. They can predict, and then they do RB at times. So I feel personally that, yes, high-frequency guys, HFT shops, they are doing that today too. And, of course, I think they were definitely doing that earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think that high-frequency traders, though, even though they have a bad name sometimes associated, they are a source of liquidity as well, added volume to the marketplace. For longer-term investors, I don't see any issue with them being an, you know, the high-frequency trader being an active liquidity provider in the marketplace. For the short-term investor trying, or short-term trader trying to trade against the high-frequency, I mean, they're, you know, out of luck in that one because they're not going to be able to beat some of the bigger players. And then I guess to the SOR side, you know, I personally use a smart order router that what we do is they see the timing to each exchange, and so that we don't have the high-frequency guys fade on us, we make sure that the order gets to each exchange at the same time simultaneously, and then hopefully we get a full fill.
Yeah, one thing that struck me about the latency arbitrage debate that I found really interesting, not only was the I think it was maybe 2014 that exchanges were forced to disclose how, you know, when they used fast price feeds and when they used the SIP, and, you know, for pricing trades and for compliance with Reg NMS. But also in conjunction around that time, FINRA issued guidance that said if a off-exchange market maker or broker was using fast price feeds for its own trading, that it couldn't really use the SIP as the benchmark for customer order flow. So with that as context, I want to ask this next question, which also has an order type dimension. If people know me, that's one of my topics. But has the industry sufficiently incorporated HFT know-how into smart order routers? And what about special order types and the use of direct feeds?
So I would say yes to most of those points. So I think most smart order routers have incorporated those things. What ends up happening is oftentimes it's like you get a Ferrari, but instead of driving on a proper road, you're trying to drive it on a dirt road. So I think those are the challenges. One advantage that an HFT has over most banks is they're not regulated the way banks are regulated. So they have an edge, they have an advantage. But if you come to normal technology, that part, that aspect, I would say yes. The order types, if they are in public domain, then yes, we have them in our smart order routers. If they're not in public domain, then of course, then that's not playing fair.
So some of the high frequency trading shops, they have open broker dealer subsidiaries and offer, I guess, maybe light versions of their smart order router to the, you know, to the professional public today. So, you know, I've seen, you know, Citadels and Virtus, and, you know, so you get some of the same access without all, you know, the technology behind it.
Well, I will disagree somewhat. I think if we talk about more standard smart order routers available from vendors, available from brokers, you know, commercially available, I don't think they have much of HFT components in them. To be honest with you, I have not seen, and I've done thorough analysis. So that's why we come in, and so any of the proprietary shops, any of the hedge funds, high frequency trading shops, are actually building their own, maybe using some of the more basic components available from commercially available smart order routers, but always building their own knowledge, their own neural network, their own decision making for what we discussed about maker taker and the rebates. Practically none of this is available in smart order routers that I had seen available. So you have to put in a lot of logic, a lot of capability into those to make it really work for those real active trading strategies that we're discussing here.
All right, switching topics, and still all centered on execution and smart order routing. Can the members of the panel comment on how the access to dark markets, to dark liquidity, has evolved, and where is the industry going in terms of proper best practices approach to accessing dark liquidity?
So I would say so the reason why we have dark pools and other off exchange transaction places is primarily to prevent information leakage. And that's the biggest challenge, and that's the reason why we do that. So yes, a lot of brokers, they come up with their own ways to basically internalize the flow and either fill the client order from their own inventory or hunt for the counterparty. Now, whether they go to a dark pool or do it internally or you send out IOIs to do that, those are just different ways to achieve the same goal. And I think technology-wise, we have improved. And as a broker, I would say that we do offer best execution to our clients. And we provide the full transparency. They can see what we're doing, how we're doing. I mean, I think that's the key thing.
Yeah, I mean, for me, something I use a lot is the FINRA published data. Ever since FINRA required ATSs to publish trailing data, you know, it's great to see where are securities trading in the dark. And, you know, you can kind of figure out, hey, so most recently, these have been the hottest pools. And it's kind of like a popularity contest at the end of the day. It's, there's no pool that's going to be better for any other reason besides that that's where the liquidity lies.
Yeah, I think the technology improved. I agree. Now it's easier to access, it's easier to find, it's easier to compare different pools with each other, knowing what kind of liquidity is available there. Even though it's not fully lit liquidity, you can still find ways of understanding the liquidity structure of those marketplaces and pools. But at the same time, I think there is more. So those dark pools are also diversifying their structure, right? So they're trying to also implement different strategies, different order types, different ways of subscribing to market data, things like that, right? So I think there's innovation both from the market structure perspective of those pools as well as the technology to access that liquidity.
So one of the things I think is interesting about the called the dark markets, not to be too contentious here, but there have been each year, in at least the last 3 or 4 years, we've had some major enforcement actions by the New York Attorney General and by the SEC. And there seems to be a common theme that that dark pools require and need to court liquidity providers in the same way that exchanges do, and that many of these enforcement actions have to do with not properly disclosing who you're trading with, under what conditions, and some information leakage. So I'd like the panel to comment less about those, the enforcement actions, but more about the fact that off-exchange liquidity is kind of dependent on the same crowd of characters as the exchange liquidity.
So I think, I know a couple of years ago, we had this whole sub-penny issue with dark pools. And of course, afterwards, SEC came up with a guideline to address that, CRADAT that rule and all those things. So I do agree that dark pools do need to play by some rules, absolutely, definitely. And yes, there has to be some more transparency. They need to be maybe semi-dark, perhaps.
And they're doing this, right? So that's what I said, you know. So I'm seeing more and more openness from those dark pools to also provide certain transparency, provide certain information. And regulations actually, you know, do require them to disclose certain information now.
On our call, we talked also about basically internal crossing between clients. You've mentioned just recently internalization. So I was kind of trying to, you know, aim this kind of question to kind of comparing and contrasting, you know, the dark liquidity that kind of attracts in liquidity providers versus dark liquidity that's seeking to, you know, kind of transact in a way that does not have that interaction with, you know, let's say HFTs or traditional market makers. So maybe you could talk about how, you know, these are obviously contradictory notions. So how does, if you design a smart order routing service or process, how do you address those that kind of contradictory incentives? You need liquidity and you want to avoid information leakage.
I mean, for me, when I'm using a smart order router, I personally don't want to sweep the dark pools before going to lit exchanges, just because it does tend to signal the market and you would see, you know, the screens move on you. So, I mean, what I do know is that when it comes to more natural, longer-term investors, there's a lot of buy-side only venues now between Luminex and, you know, Liquinet has their own, and I'm sure there's a bunch of other ones. So it's just when it's talking about smart order routers, I try to kind of separate the two. Personally, I think smart order routers work better with maybe the hidden book of lit exchanges as well as the lit markets, and I, you know, I personally try not to access dark liquidity through my smart order router.
Well, that's what I kind of mentioned also earlier, that you have to be careful with smart order routers and implement your own logic in there. You've collected enough information over the history of your trade, your trade history, to do that analysis of knowing, well, what is the size of your order, what instrument you're dealing with, where it's being traded, the fee structure. Everything has to be available to you for that real-time analysis when the order comes into the smart order router. So if you've collected this information, you can use it to make a better approach to which venue you're going to hit first, how you're going to be getting this information, how you're going to be split your order into different placements, so on and so forth. So I would say that an analysis that you do, you know, call it transaction cost analysis, call it historical analysis, call it backtesting, whatever you call it, but it has to be the results of that analysis has to be available to your smart order router to make that right decision.
So I think it is a hard problem. Like, if you first go to a lit exchange, then of course you've shown your hand. If you go to the dark pool, then by the time you, maybe it won't have enough liquidity for you, and then by the time you come back to the lit pool, then maybe you've run out of liquidity. So it is a hard problem. So like Michael said, that ideally you would want to go to first the buy side clients. Hopefully they would service your, provide you liquidity, and without you showing the hands to everyone. And that's what we do too. Like, we use IOIs for achieving that part of the goal. And that's one way we do it.
Hopefully actionable IOIs.
That too.
maybe you could talk more, you talk about pre-trade analysis. You know, we've had, you know, a few years ago, I think the notion of venue toxicity became kind of a popular debate point. So maybe the question is, you know, what is a toxic venue? Why are some venues have such different performance than others? And to what degree are those differences identifiable in real time through pre-trade analysis?
Basically that's a common part of a pre-trade analysis every day now, is a venue analysis. So, you know, you create your routing tables based on what are the least toxic venues, you know, where am I going to get the most liquidity. So when judging venues, my number one thing I look at is the markout, is reversion statistics, you know, on short-term basis. I look out a millisecond to, you know, 10 milliseconds, up to 30 seconds, just to see what happened to the market. And what you know, my thought is that the reason a venue would be toxic or not is really just the participants, you know, in that venue.
So I would say, like, some of the ECNs, what they do is they're just regurgitating the liquidity from other exchanges. So they're not true liquidity providers. And that is, I think, a big issue. So that's how we label a particular ECN as toxic or not toxic. If they're not true market makers, they're not providing true liquidity, then that's not an exchange you would go to. And like Michael said, like, you do all your technical analysis, you do their fill ratio, look at all those numbers. And coming back, like I said, a lot of these exchanges, they're just looking at one exchange and another one, and they're just regurgitating liquidity. That is it. That is it. It's just false liquidity.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, I would say sometimes it's unpredictable. You know, some of the exchanges, some of the liquidity pools are very unpredictable in terms of the response times, latency, things like that. And so that becomes an issue. You know, you're building a certain strategy. We're talking about, latency arbitrage and other things, and then you're hitting this exchange and it gives you 10 times the delay that that killed your whole strategy, right? So again, you know, you need to, that also makes a toxic exchange in a way when it's unpredictable so much.
Yeah, I've recently removed different venues that have, you know, cancel latency of 10 milliseconds. It's pretty crazy.
I remember in FX world, like I used to be in FX in a past life. So there are a lot of these venues, they would allow last looks, and that would create problems, like coming back to what you just said, like it just adds delays and then the entire strategy just falls on the floor.
Maybe you could just elaborate more in terms of, what's state of the art now? We can always calculate these metrics. We can have them on screens. But, to what degree are these called dynamic order routing based on toxicity? To what degree is that automated now? Where's the responsibility? Is the responsibility with the broker still, or are there clients that are starting to check their brokers by using third-party apps? I don't know as much about what's happening this year. Maybe you could talk about that.
I don't know about the third-party stuff, but like I know for us, like all our clients, they ask for TC reports, absolutely, and we provide them. So we help them slice and dice data in every which way that they want. So absolutely. So we try to provide them all the data. So again, it comes back to transparency. You have to make sure that the client is getting what he or she wants. So that's what we try to deliver.
Yeah, I'd second that. You know, it's very important to be as transparent as possible with order routing these days. Everything's under a microscope. Whether it's the fixed tags coming back, you know, everyone wants to see their tag 30s and their tag 851s on each execution so they can run their own analysis. But it's the broker's responsibility to do that deeper dive and find out, hey, you know, what's really going on with this order right now.
Well, but you have to question the brokers, right? Here's what would be ideal in my situation, right? So if the broker provided enough flexibility, enough configuration for me to change, to change their settings, to implement my additional custom logic inside of their standard strategies or standard algos, that would be more important for me than just to compare numbers from different brokers. I mean, we do that too, obviously, and that's the data that I mentioned that goes into your decision logic for smart order routers through which brokers, through which infrastructure, through which exchange to go to. But also, having an ability of customizing based to your needs, based on how you wanted to optimize your algo.
All right, so I think we'll do a final question and then we'll hand it over to the audience for questions. So if you were going to summarize, the opinion of each of the panel members, if you were going to summarize what you think was the most important topic or issue to spend time on, many problems in the past have been solved, the industry's evolving. For this year and going forward, what do you think is the most important issue to address?
Personally, as an agency broker, I'd really like to see this maker-taker program tackled, just because I've always been agnostic to cost, whether it bites me in the butt at the end of the day or not, it's a different story. But if I would be really interested to see the results of a maker-taker pilot and see if it reduces queue lines and, you know, helps out with our markouts and different things like that.
For me, it would be, you know, the new regime, like, so we are, so things, the pendulum swung in one direction and we decided to, like, we slapped on Volcker rule, this rule, that rule. And now the pendulum has swung in the other way and we are saying, huh, let's dilute the Volcker rule, let's dilute Dodd-Frank. I'll be very curious to see what comes out of that. Will the pendulum swing again in the other previous direction, or will it swing in a new direction, or it won't swing at all?
I agree with that, and just actually I wanted to say pretty much the same thing. We live in a very unpredictable environment, both regulatory as well as politically, as well as economically, globally. So it's I think having or building that flexibility into the technology that we are delivering is extremely important right now, right? So being too quickly able to go in and pull this rule out or replace it with something else, you know, like we talked about toxic venues, how quickly can you remove this venue? How quickly can you add this, right? So that, having that agility and flexibility in your trading process, I'd say is the most important thing for me.
Okay, great. So we have some questions here. It says, you spoke of this already, but how do you define a toxic venue? Do you look intraday?
Absolutely look intraday. It has to be dynamically checked.
Yeah, if you have the technology available, definitely intraday is best. Post-trade, you know, it would be at the bare minimum.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. Yeah.
Sean Gibson from Lex Securities. So my question, Haim, is what is your opinion on the maker-taker model?
I think it was in my book. I wanted back in 2012 to cut it down to 5 mils cap and call it a day. Having the experience that Sauer mentioned of how exchanges have implemented fee structures globally. I think of maker taker is just simply a sub-penny adjustment and sub-penny pricing, because it just changes the economics. And I think when you have a situation where sub-pennies are treated economically as sub-pennies, but then from a regulatory perspective to a single price at an NBBO, which then allows a broker to have conflicts of interest, you know, I think that's toxic. So I guess, my answer is eliminate the distortion of the fee structure. And if markets are not tight enough, then permit sub-penny pricing. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our Best Execution podcast from our recent Intelligent Trading Summit. We'll post some more podcasts from the event over the next few days. For more trading technology content from A-Team Group, visit our website at intelligenttradingtechnology.com. You can also sign up on the website for our next Intelligent Trading Summit, which will be in London on the 28th of November and is free of charge for financial institutions.